Thank you, Kirkland, for reading that passage for us. Thank you, Adam, for the water. When last I spoke, last week, it was about the Lord's Supper, and I didn't say this, but it was a bringing to close my series of lessons on the Christian assembly. As I move back toward the book of Genesis, I'd like us to stop for a moment in 2 Chronicles. So if you didn't turn or click there before, go ahead and head that way. We're going to look at the reign of a king, Asa. I had a friend growing up named Asa, so I guess that's why that pronunciation stuck for me. But did you catch the prophet Azariah, what he said? The Lord is with you when you are with him. That's a great assurance there. If you seek him, he will be found by you. In their distress, Israel turned to the Lord, sought him, and he was found by them. Now, the Kings and the Chronicles are the spiritual history or genealogy of God's people. It's history, but how often when you read a history book, or as you're hearing somebody speak and make history, perhaps on the television or the radio, would you like to know what's really going on spiritually with them? What's really going on? You have to look no further. God shows you, at least with his people, the spiritual condition of his people. And we see here God's people and their courage to seek the Lord, their courage to seek the Lord in their distress. I'd like to talk about courageously seeking God in our distress. A while back, I think it was the lectureship up in Fairbanks, our family was coming back from Fairbanks, and we stopped at that great place to view Denali when it's out. We wanted to get a picture of all of us. It's me and my wife, and we have two toddlers. So you know that's an impossible goal to try and get a good picture of yourself. So we were trying to get a picture, and we asked this lady to take the picture for us, and she tried, but there was always one of us looking some other place. It was me getting ready, you know, to discipline our kids, or the kids were looking off somewhere. So we were just about to ask her for a retake, because she took about 6 pictures, and none of them were really very good. But right before we asked her, we found out that this was a grandmother, and this grandmother had just lost her grandson to an illness. We were coming back from Fairbanks to the valley, and they had just been from Fairbanks all the way to Anchorage and had lost their grandson who had been sick, and they were headed back. Are you going to ask that person for a retake? Hey, I know you've got troubles, but I need a good picture for the Christmas card. Such a loss, such an impact, no doubt would show up in their family history. If you did a genealogy of them, that's going to show up that this child was taken from them. But these were people of faith, and they told us so. And in our presence, they had the courage to cry out to God in their distress. They believed that though God could relieve their pain, that he was most eager that their souls would grow through this experience. Now, that doesn't bring back the child, but doesn't that color the spiritual history of this family differently? Let's go keep a marker in 2 Chronicles 15, because that's going to be the culmination of where we end up. But 1 Kings 15, if you can turn back there, gives us a little bit of insight into one of our first characters here. I'll just have the scriptures up here so you know where we will be at. 1 Kings 15 tells us about Abijam, or Abijah as he's called in 2 Chronicles. And this is Asa's father. Asa's father is a man who had fallen away from his faith. So place that in your mind. Maybe you have experienced that, or maybe you have that in your family. Someone who has fallen away. 1 Kings 15, verse 1. Now, in the 18th year of King Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, that's on Israel's side, Abijam began to reign over Judah. He reigned for 3 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Maacah, the daughter of Abishalom, and he walked in all the sins that his father did before him, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God as the heart of David his father had been. Abijam's family had lost their faith. Religion for them, if you tried to bring it up in a conversation, would perhaps have a sour taste, would leave a sour taste in their mouth. But we see here that God is interested, even when his people fall away, he's interested in making that known. I mean, these are his children, and he's giving us full disclosure about where they are at. Let's go back to 2 Chronicles 13, and we'll stay here for most of our time. The problem was, is Abijah, as he's called in 13, the faithless father, he now faces an enemy. And let's look at the circumstances that he faces here. 2 Chronicles 13, you'll notice it reads very similar. In the 18th year of King Jeroboam, Abijah began to reign over Judah. Deja vu, right? He reigned for 3 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Micaiah, the daughter of Uriel of Gibeah. Just different names for the same people. Now, there was war between Abijah and Jeroboam. Now, get your calculators out, because we're going to have to do some figuring. Abijah went out to battle, having an army of valiant men of war, 400,000 chosen men. That's a lot. And Jeroboam drew up his line of battle against him with 800,000 chosen men. So what's the math on that? 2-1. If there was ever a time to send a delegation and make peace, this was the time. The odds were overwhelming. However, they don't have a king who's going to cry out to God. If you read the rest of the middle part of chapter 13, you see all that Abijah does is he gets up and he just talks about how faithless Jeroboam is, which there's certainly some truth to that. But Abijah won't cry out to God in his distress. Crying out to God is a courageous act, but no one else can do it for you. And often it's an act that requires us to grow on the inside. So let's look what happens to the people. Verse 13, this is the people of Judah who are the subjects under Abijah. Jeroboam had set up an ambush. Sorry, this is verse 13 in chapter 13. Jeroboam set up an ambush. Oh, so we're outnumbered and they're going to ambush us. That sounds great. Around to come up from behind them. Thus, his troops were in front of Judah, and the ambush was behind them. And when Judah looked, and this is the David paraphrase, they realized their king was not going to cry out to God. And David's paraphrase. When they looked behind, behold, the battle was in front and behind, and they cried to the Lord. They looked around and they said, we're outnumbered and we're surrounded. Our only hope is to cry out to God. Which really is the way that it has to be. That's the thesis of 1 and 2 Kings and the Chronicles, is that no king will ever be perfect enough to match God. And certainly world history has revealed to us, this is a quotation from a man, no political reform will ever be successful without personal reform. No political reform will ever last unless we as individuals commit ourselves to living virtuously. The men of Judah realized no one else can cry out to God for us. We must do that. Let's skip, we'll leave that battle, because this happens again, except it happens in the life of Asa. 2 Chronicles 14, make sure I'm keeping up on my slides here. Go to the next chapter, 2 Chronicles 14, 1 through 4. Abijah slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David, and Asa his son reigned in his place. In his days the land had rest for 10 years, and Asa did what was good and right in the eyes of the Lord his God. He took away the foreign altars and the high places, and broke down the pillars, and cut down the Asherim, and commanded Judah to seek the Lord, the God of their fathers, and to keep the law and the commandment. So Abijah, the father, he was a man who had lost his faith. Maybe some of you have experienced that, or you know someone who's experienced that. But Asa is one who comes with faith, and he's trying to hold on to his faith. And he's experienced people falling away, and yet it seems like he is committed to holding on to his faith. Nevertheless, Asa finds himself in a very similar position to his father. Go down to verse 8 in 2 Chronicles 14. Get your calculators out again. And Asa had an army of 300,000 from Judah, armed with large shields and spears, and 280,000 men from Benjamin that carried shields and drew bows. All these were mighty men of valor. Zerah, the Ethiopian, came out against them with an army of how many? 1 million men and 300 chariots for good measure. Came out as far as Marisha. Are the odds any better for Asa? But Asa is a man of faith, right? He's a man who's trying to hold on to his faith. Shouldn't God have whittled down the Ethiopians a little more for him? Asa, like the men of Judah during the time of his father, must also cry out to God in distress. Asa went out to meet him, verse 10, and they drew up their lines in the battle in the valley of Zarephath and Marisha, and Asa cried to the Lord. It's the same exact act and phrase that they did before. He cried out to the Lord, "O Lord, there is none like you to help between the mighty and the weak. Help us, O Lord our God, for we rely on you, and in your name we have come against this multitude. O Lord, you are our God. Let not man prevail against you." Isn't that a wonderful prayer that Asa offers up in his distress and his hopelessness and these overwhelming circumstances? I mean, take yourself back to the last time, maybe it wasn't very long ago, when you were facing, an illness or some, ethical dilemma at work or some issue with the family, and you're just like, I have nowhere to turn. I must cry out to God. I have no one else to turn to. I'm outnumbered, and they have me surrounded. Notice how God responds. They both cry out, Judah and Asa both cry out to God, and in both instances, God responds the same way. If you go back to chapter 13, verse 15, "Then the men of Judah raised the battle shout, and when the men of Judah shouted, God defeated Jeroboam." Chapter 14, verse 12, "So the Lord defeated the Ethiopians." There's an odd thing. I'm not a Hebrew scholar, so I couldn't figure out which was which, but there's an odd thing about the word defeated. The Lord defeated the enemy. This could mean to gore someone. As you're walking into the fair, there, one of the entrances, there's that 2,000-pound bull. Did anyone see that monstrosity? Imagine getting gored by that thing. I mean, that's power right there. God gored these enemies. You want to know what the other possible interpretation of God defeating the enemies is? He stubbed their toe. Which sounds unequal, but how useful are you after you stub your toe? You ready to go out and fight 1 million-man army after you stub your toe? I mean, the point here is, I don't know how God brought victory to Asa and to the men of Judah. I don't know how God has brought victory into your life, but if he does it by stubbing the toe of the enemy or by goring them with a 2,000-pound bull, God wins the victory. God defeats. And you've had those experiences in your life. You finally figure out like the way in which God brought that about, and you thought, I would have never thought of that. Now, facing outwardly a 1 million-man army, that's an apparent example of courage, right? The soldier is rightly due honor because of the courage that they display in facing the enemy. But does it not also take courage to face up to our personal struggles, be it some kind of sin or insecurity or personal problem we have? How much courage does it take to stand up to a family member who is trying to influence you in the wrong way? How much courage does it take to stand up to opposition from acquaintances or friends or coworkers? You know, I found in my experience that often pressures that I have on the outside, enemies that I face on the outside, end up being indicators of growth that I must engage in on the inside. Asa's family kept running into this same problem, but they never really got resolution until they started cleaning up their own household. I'll show you why I think this, if you don't think it's true from your own experience. 2 Chronicles 15, do you remember what Kirkland read to us? Do you remember there in verse 7? This is after the men of Judah have faced Jeroboam's large army, and this is after Asa has faced the million-man army. Now, Azariah says, but you take courage. Do not let your hands be weak, for your work shall be rewarded. I thought the battles have already been fought. I thought the victories have already been won. God has relieved the external distress. Now Asa must take courage in growing within himself, in maturing within himself. Verse 8, as soon as Asa heard these words, the prophecy of Azariah, the son of Oded, he took courage and he put away the detestable idols from all the land of Judah and Benjamin, and from the cities that he had taken in the hill country of Ephraim, and he repaired the altar of the Lord who was in front of the vestibule of all the house of the Lord. And he gathered all Judah and Benjamin and those from Ephraim and Manasseh and Simeon who were residing with him, for great numbers had deserted to Asa from Israel when they saw that the Lord his God was with him. Verse 12, and they all enter into a covenant to seek the Lord their God of their fathers with all their heart and with all their soul. You see, he had to go home after winning this army, and he had to start saying yes to things. He had to start making a habit of saying yes to things like worship. I'm gonna create opportunities for us to worship corporately. I'm going to create opportunities where our families can worship in and of themselves. He had to make a habit of saying yes to gathering the people together rather than allowing them to be dispersed on their own. He had to say yes to things like remembering the covenant. Hey, we are in a covenant with God. We have committed to Him. And did you catch what he had to start doing other parts there? He had to say no to some things. What did he have to say no to? Right, the politician is popular until he starts saying, well, we need to take a moral stand on things, or we're going to start cleaning up this place. Suddenly, folks aren't quite as eager to follow that kind of an idea. He says no to things that would replace God as authority. He starts getting rid of the idols. And some of these idols, it says in 1 Kings 15, were male cult prostitution and Asherim poles, and these really degrading and odd things that somehow society had said, well, everyone seems to think it's okay, so let's just leave it. But here's the kicker. What does he have to do in verse 16? Even Maakah, his mother, King Asa, removed from being queen mother because she had made a detestable image from Asherah. Asa had to get rid of mama. Now, don't use that as a license to go rebel against your mom if she wants you to eat your vegetables and do your homework. What was going on with this queen mother? She was a woman of authority, and she was influencing the rest of the people to do things that were foolish and harmful. And Asa had defeated a million-person army, but do you think standing up to his mama was one of the hardest things that he had to do? Now, I don't want to give the impression that we are saved or that Asa was saved because he cleared this filth out of his life or because he was maturing. He was initially saved because he relied upon and cried out to God. Colossians 3, verse 1, I'm glad that David pointed that out a little bit extra today. the beginning of that verse. If then you have been raised with Christ, if you have been raised with Christ, if you have cried out to him, if you had made your appeal to God in baptism and have been raised to a new life, then we seek the higher things. We are not saved because we clean this stuff out of our life, but we are saved so that we may live a life of virtue. And that, in today's world, as it did back then, takes courage. Asa's distress led him to courageous work of setting and keeping his house in order. If you will indulge me for a moment, I have a story that I would like to read. It's a modern-day fable. And I'd like you to think, we're going to read about a woman named Jean. What advice would you give Jean? A modern-day fable for you, Jean and Jane. Jean and Jane were very good friends, but Jean and Jane were in no way alike. For Jane was very friendly, always cheerful, always happy, but Jean was more reflective, rarely laughing, rarely smiling. While Jean stayed pretty much to herself, even in groups, Jane was the life of every party. While Jane entered any room and immediately attracted a crowd, Jean entered any room and remained so inconspicuous it was as if she were not there. Jean was not really less attractive, yet she attracted less. Jane was not really a superficial butterfly, yet she was never alone. As time went on, Jean began to worry about the difference. Why is it, she thought, that Jane always has more fun? Why is it that I, on the other hand, am always so unhappy? Does Jane simply know better how to win friends and influence people? Have you read that book, by the way? If so, where did she learn it? And why haven't I, Jean, learned this? Jean reflected on her own patterns and came to see that there was no clear reason for their difference. She and Jane were the same age and had about the same physical attributes. Jane was blonde, Jean was brunette. They each could sing, each played the same game of tennis. Okay, well, Jane was a better swimmer, but she couldn't play golf. The more Jean thought about Jane, the more depressed she became. It was not just envy. Jane was the reflection of her, Jean's, own potential. Jane, right now, in the present, was all that Jean ever wanted to be, but somehow found herself unable to be. As Jean brooded about this problem, things worsened. She isolated herself more. Then she functioned less. Eventually, she stopped going out at all. And who would have wanted to be around her anyway? Throughout this time, Jane continued on her way. Almost every evening, the phone rang. At the club, she was invited to every activity, for she was, after all, a pleasure to be with. Even at work, others admitted that they worked harder in her presence, and she almost never had to eat by herself. Finally, Jean, with great effort, managed to establish a relationship with a therapist. Weekly she went, and she began to discuss her problem, how no one seemed to want her, how she was usually left out of things, if not completely ignored, how jealous she was of Jane. Slowly she talked about her behavior. Carefully she revealed her inner feelings. Hesitantly she discussed her past. As time went by, she made some progress, but it always seemed to be overshadowed by Jane, who, if this was possible, became even more popular than before. Thus, Jane continued to be a reminder to Jean of what a woman could be. Ha! Thought Jean one day, about 6 months after she had begun to work on her problem. Why, if Jane ever had to see someone for professional help, she'd probably be through in a matter of weeks. It was in the midst of one of these doldrums that Jean, upon entering her therapist's office, was astounded to see Jane coming out. Hi, Jean, said Jane in her usual cheery way. Hi, responded Jean, surprised. What are you doing here? Asked Jane sweetly. Me, said Jean. Why, I've been coming here for almost a year. This is my regular weekly appointment. What brings you here today? Well, we had to switch today. I've been seeing the doctor for several years now, said Jane, still her usual eager self. I wish I could cut down to only once a week. But how often do you come? Inquired Jean incredulously. Usually 3 times, but sometimes I'm really desperate. He fits me in for a fourth. Desperate, exclaimed Jean. Oh, yes, responded Jane. You know, Jean, I can't tell you how surprised I am to find you here. You always seem so sure of yourself. You're always so self-reliant, always so able to be alone. You have no idea how I admire your independence, your tolerance for solitude, and your capacity to keep your distance. Jean was still trying to come out from behind the other side of the mirror as she finally asked, "But Jane, what's your problem?" "You mean you can't tell?" chirped Jane. "I am totally unable to say no." So Jean and Jane come to you. What advice would you give to them? How would turning to God, you notice that was kind of a godless fable. There was never any talk of turning toward God. How would turning to God, even crying out to God, grow Jean spiritually? You've known those people. Without faith, our attempts to reform ourselves carry us to extremes in our behavior. But turning to God frees us from destroying ourselves, frees us from, in jealousy, despising those around us. Once we are converted, and we must be converted to having Jesus as our Lord, but once we are converted to having Jesus as our Lord, I believe it's less about changing who you are and more about growing up in what God has given you to be. There was a wise mother, since I've sort of thrown Asa's mother under the bus, I should say something good about mothers, but she told her daughter this, and this was a daughter who was butting heads with her mom all the time and jealous of her friends. And this was back in the 1800s, and rather than being super obsessed with their appearance, they were really obsessed with their health. And yet, this is what her mother told her. "I wish I could make you see that God is just as willing and just as able to sanctify as he is to redeem us." And then he says, this is what she must go do. "Go on praying. Pray without ceasing." God has redeemed the Christian, but he is more than willing and more than able to sanctify you. If we would cry out to God, if we would pray, and if we would pray ceaselessly to him for all of our needs, the courage to take God at his word, the Lord is with you while you are with him. If you seek him, he will be found by you. Crying out to God is the courage to proclaim and to trust that he's the one directing our affairs. And he has made us exactly how he needs us to make a difference in this world for his kingdom. So I pray we will also take courage. As you go before God, he is more than willing to relieve our pain, and he will relieve our pain. But God is more eager that he would grow us in our soul. If there's a need that the church can help you with, if there's pain that you are carrying, if there's growth that you'd like to have help with to take place in your life, now is a good time to come forward while we stand and sing together.